A Story Publishing presents Oxford, A Tapestry of Time. Prologue. Dawn lingers over the two rivers that crisscross Oxford, as mist rises from the Cherwell and curls across the Isis like parchment smoke. From the summit of Carfax Tower, a watcher might trace the city's chronology in a single sweep. The Norman mound of the castle, the 15th century spire of St. Mary the Virgin, Christopher Wren's 17th century cupola, and, almost within arm's reach of the railway, the glass atrium of the Said Business School. The stones appear static, yet every bell stroke revealed how restlessly this place has reinvented itself. 900 years earlier, when the first itinerant masters arrived, the same damp breath of river hung over timber shops. They lectured in hired rooms, explaining grammar, rhetoric, and logic to adolescents who scrawled notes by candlelight. The king who set that fragile experiment on its path, Henry II, sits now in distant memory, but his 1167 decree banning English clerks from Paris still echoes down these lanes. He never visited Oxford after the edict. Nonetheless, each quarter hour, his unseen hand nudges the clock of the university church that grew from his decision. 2 centuries later, Walter de Merton arrives in the mind's eye, dismounting beside a half-built hall. He unrolls a sheaf of statutes in which every line is inked as carefully as a legal deed. Fellows shall elect their own warden, estates shall be held in common, scholars shall debate every fortnight. Around him, masons chip at seen stone, raising walls that will outlast plague and civil war. Merton could not have imagined electric lights or global stock markets, yet the corporate idea he fixed in parchment, an academic community owning itself, proved supple enough to survive them. Another turn of the tower clock summons Sir Thomas Bodley. It is 1602, and he treads the dust of a neglected library, envisioning shelves that will admit every printed book in England. Soon the Bodleian's heavy oak doors swing open, and chains clink as volumes take their places. Bodley's bargain with the Stationer's Company, one copy of every title for perpetual safekeeping, anchors a principle as modern as it is old. Knowledge should be both protected and shared. He leaves no heir, only a seal impressed with a beaver, an animal said never to sleep lest the current carry it away. Skip forward to the hiss of a steam whistle. In 1854, Parliament presses Oxford to reform, questioning whether prayer-soaked cloisters can serve an industrial nation. The answer unfolds in iron girders and gas-lit laboratories, then in lecture halls where women petition for entry and scientists debate the age of the earth. The city resists, concedes, adjusts. By the time the railway bridge spans the canal, the university has rewritten its statutes, accepted microscopes alongside manuscripts, and opened its gates wider than any founder dared envision. Twilight falls, and the sequence reaches a concrete platform on Rewley Road. It is 1996, and a former goods yard echoes with pigeons until a Syrian Saudi philanthropist, Wafik Saeed, steps onto the cracked asphalt. He imagines an amphitheater of glass and stone where students from Lagos, Lima, and Lahore will dissect balance sheets and question the morality of capital itself. Many doubt the fit. Can one of Europe's oldest universities credibly teach entrepreneurship amid cloisters? Yet the cranes rise, and within 5 years, a new quad of photovoltaic panels and limestone colonnades mirrors the medieval pattern while bending it toward tomorrow. From Henry's embargo to Said's benefaction stretches a single unbroken thread, the capacity of Oxford to reconfigure itself without surrendering its core. Each era's solution, clerical immunity, collegiate endowment, legal deposit, parliamentary reform, philanthropic venture, responded to a pressure its predecessors never faced. The question, whispered beneath every archway, is whether the next reinvention will prove as durable as the last. Morning light now strikes the Radcliffe camera's honeyed curve and ricochets onto laptops open in the Bodleian's reading rooms. A doctoral candidate downloads genomic data while a classicist compares digital facsimiles of papyrus. Outside, cyclists weave past tourists, and the 7-ton bell in Tom Tower readies its nightly call. The city appears poised, but its equilibrium is temporary, balanced between heritage that resists and curiosity that insists. What force knits such contradictions into continuity? Is it geography, nestled between two rivers that both shield and constrain? Is it law, refined through centuries of charters and commissions? Is it architecture's slow persuasion, or is it the habits of argument, the rituals of communal dining and disputation that teach each generation to question without rupture? The pages ahead pursue that riddle, tracing how a market town became a university, how a university became a city, and how that city now speaks to a planet negotiating change at unprecedented speed. The tower clock marks another quarter hour, and the bells ripple across roofs tiled in Cotswold slate, glass canopies, and Victorian brick. Somewhere a first-year student looks up, startled by the sound, unsure whether it signals the start of morning prayers or the close of a trading floor in New York. In that flicker of uncertainty lies the reason to continue. Oxford's story is not a museum exhibit. It is an unfinished argument about the terms on which knowledge meets power, tradition meets innovation, and local lanes meet global currents. Let the reader descend the tower's spiral stair, step onto High Street, and walk east toward the fog still draining from the riverbeds. The path ahead leads into Chapter 1, but the echo of these bells will accompany every page. End of prologue. If we could stroll along Oxford's High Street late in the 12th century, we would not find the ordered quadrangles or stone libraries that tourists admire today. Instead, the town presented a Saxon street grid of timber-framed shops clustered between two rivers, the Cherwell to the east, and the Upper Thames, locally called the Isis, to the south. Mist drifted from the water meadows at dawn, wrapping the low wooden bridges in damp silence. At the center of this modest market settlement rose the Tower of St. George's at Oxford Castle and the spire of the fledgling parish church of St. Mary the Virgin, reminders that the line between civil and ecclesiastical authority was still porous. It was here, in rented chambers behind taverns, or in side chapels lit by tallow candles, that itinerant masters began lecturing on the seven liberal arts, following pedagogical models imported from cathedral schools in Laon and Chartres. Those seven liberal arts, revived across Europe after the turn of the millennium, were divided into two ordered groups. The trivium, grammar, rhetoric, and logic, equipped students to read, speak, and reason persuasively. Grammar demanded command of Latin, the shared academic language of Christendom. Rhetoric provided techniques for structuring arguments, a vital skill in courts and chancelleries. Logic, or dialectic, trained scholars to test contradictions systematically, preparing them for disputations that were already becoming the hallmark of higher education. Only after mastering this linguistic and analytical toolkit could a student progress to the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Arithmetic dealt with the properties of number. Geometry extended number into space, drawing on translations of Euclid arriving from Islamic Spain. Music, seen mathematically as the harmony of ratios, straddled theory and devotion because chant depended on these principles. Astronomy pointed eyes and compasses skyward, essential both for calculating liturgical calendars and for navigating Europe's expanding trade networks. Together, the seven arts formed the propedeutic curriculum that any serious scholar, whether aspiring theologian, lawyer, or physician, had to complete before proceeding to advanced study. Oxford's emergence as the principal English venue for this learning owed less to local initiative than to royal decree. In 1167, King Henry II, still smarting from political frictions with Louis VII after Thomas Becket's murder, forbade his subjects to enroll at the University of Paris. The edict redirected a trickle of English clerks back across the Channel. Many came to Oxford because the town lay on the main north-south road between London and the Midlands, reachable in 2 days by horseback, and buffered by rivers that doubled as defensive moats. Landlords quickly discovered that letting attics to scholars was more profitable than leasing them to woolpackers. Within a decade, rents rose enough to prompt the first documented conflicts between townspeople and the growing academic population, an early hint of the tension, later known simply as Town and Gown. Lectures often convened under the timbered roof of St. Mary the Virgin, whose nave, though narrow by modern standards, offered the only hall large enough to gather 100 students at once. Masters stood on a raised stone pulpitum, reading from parchment copies secured by cords to prevent theft. Manuscripts were scarce. Oxford possessed no formal library, so monks at nearby Osney Abbey or the Augustinian Priory at St. Frideswides occasionally lent volumes, charging hefty sureties. When a book changed hands, a notary entered the transaction into a chirograph, underscoring that knowledge, like land, was property worth recording. Yet rapid growth carried risks. In the winter of 1209, after an Oxford townswoman was found dead, local authorities arrested several scholars. No formal trial followed. Instead, the mayor ordered two to be hanged summarily. Outraged masters suspended lectures and led a mass exodus eastward. Many refugees settled in the Fenland town of Cambridge, sowing the seeds of a second English university. Meanwhile, Oxford's merchants, deprived of their best customers, petitioned King John for reconciliation. Royal letters of 1214 granted clerks the right to be tried in ecclesiastical courts, placing them under the more lenient jurisdiction of the Bishop of Lincoln, a legal privilege that forged a distinct corporate identity for the university community. When teaching resumed, the academic map of Oxford had subtly shifted. Masters now arranged themselves into self-governing congregations, electing proctors to negotiate with guild aldermen over rent caps and market tolls. St. Mary's, reaffirmed as the university church, hosted both lectures and the ceremony in which the newly elected chancellor swore to uphold scholarly privileges. Daily routine nevertheless remained austere. Students rose before dawn to chant prime, filed into lessons on Priscian's Latin grammar or Boethius's topics, and spent afternoons in formal disputations. Evenings, when not enlivened by tavern songs, were reserved for copying lecture notes onto palimpsest. Candle stubs were rationed, and a breach of curfew incurred fines payable in pennies or, more humiliatingly, in public penance before peers. Despite such discipline, Oxford was no cloistered retreat. The city thrived on England's expanding wool trade. Barges bound for London departed from nearby Folly Bridge, carrying sacks marked with the sheep's head seal of Cotswold monasteries. Masters quoted Cicero alongside royal writs, training clerks for chancery service in Westminster. By the mid-13th century, the combination of Henry II's edict, new legal privileges, and steady demand for trained clergy had transformed a collection of independent teachers into a community conscious of its collective rights and responsibilities. The essential elements of a university were in place: a recognized curriculum anchored in the trivium and quadrivium, clerical immunity in legal matters, and communal spaces such as St. Mary's that doubled as both lecture hall and parliamentary chamber. From these fragile beginnings would grow the stone colleges, libraries, and laboratories that later ages associate with the dreaming spires. Pressure to secure more permanent homes soon produced an institutional innovation, the residential college. The loose federation of masters could thrive only so long as rents remained low and landlords tolerant. By the 1240s, neither condition held. A short wheat harvest drove prices upward, and annual town taxes rose in step. Masters who wished to keep promising pupils from quitting for Paris or Bologna needed a sturdier arrangement than leased attics and improvised kitchens. Out of that practical problem emerged one of Oxford's defining institutions, the Endowed Residential College, part monastery, part boarding house, and part corporate trust. The first to take durable form was University College. Legend traced its birth to King Alfred, but the documentary trail points instead to William of Durham, an archdeacon who died in 1249. William left 310 marks, roughly 80 kilograms of silver, to support a studium in Oxford for divinity scholars. His executors invested the legacy in farmland near Durham and used the rental income to buy a modest house on School Street. There, a dozen poor masters received lodging and a daily allowance for bread and ale. Surviving statutes already contained principles that would echo through later foundations. Residents had to debate theology fortnightly, elect a custos from among themselves, and promise, in Latin phrased with lawyerly precision, to remain celibate and focused on study. A little over a decade later, John de Balliol, fined heavily after a dispute with the Bishop of Durham, agreed as part of his penance to fund a group of Oxford scholars. His widow, Dervorgilla of Galloway, regularized the gift in 1282, with statutes stipulating that her 15 scholars must dispute daily and dine together at a single table. She purchased adjoining plots on Broad Street and ordered them, enclosed with a decent wall, beginning a process of architectural consolidation that Balliol's masons would continue well into the 14th century. If University and Balliol offered early prototypes, Merton College supplied the blueprint others copied. Walter de Merton, Chancellor to Henry III and later to Edward I, issued detailed statutes in 1264. They defined a hierarchy of warden, fellows, and scholars, and crucially, placed corporate ownership of all assets in the hands of the community rather than the founder's heirs, a legal foresight that enabled Merton to outlive political upheavals that later dissolved many religious houses. The architectural consequences are still legible in stone. Merton's masons began work on Mob Quad around 1288, linking four ranges around a curt interior lawn and introducing the enclosed quadrangle that soon became emblematic of Oxford. Narrow windows, crenellated parapets, and stout gatehouses reflected defensive impulses after the civil disturbances of the 1260s, yet internal arcades offered sheltered passage even in winter rain. Different founding motives produced subtly different collegiate cultures. University emphasized theological disputation, Balliol cultivated a sharper argumentative tone, and Merton balanced liturgical observance with rigorous financial stewardship. But all three shared permanent endowment and corporate self-governance. By 1300, three colleges sheltered perhaps 150 scholars, barely a tenth of the student body, yet a disproportionately influential segment because their rents and stipends were insulated from market shocks. Architectural investment followed academic consolidation. University College's front range boasted dressed ashlar and traceried windows by 1322. Merton's library, begun circa 1373, adopted a raised roof design that admitted slanting north light. Stone walls protected libraries from fire and symbolized continuity. During the Great Famine of 1315-17 and the Black Death of 1348-49, colleges weathered crises by drawing on rural estates and by statutes mandating rapid succession when fellowships fell vacant. What began as a pragmatic response to rising rents reshaped not only Oxford's skyline, but the very meaning of a university. Individual masters still lectured, but increasingly they did so as fellows of a corporate entity, answerable to peers, supported by estates, and housed within walls whose stones spoke of permanence. In the decades that followed, this collegiate fabric would confront still larger forces: the invention of the printing press, the surge of Renaissance humanism, and the storms of the Reformation. The first great shock of technological modernity reached Oxford in 1478 when Theodoric Rude, a journeyman printer from Cologne, unpacked a wooden press just north of St. Mary's Church. Within 3 years, he had produced at least a dozen titles: Aristotle's Ethics, Duns Scotus's Commentaries, and other staples that students previously copied by hand. Output remained modest, yet the cultural consequences were immediate. Lecture halls reverberated less with dictation and more with debate over passages that every student could now consult directly. Stationers' account rolls record a 25% drop in the price of standard arts books within a decade. Knowledge was no longer hostage to the speed of a quill. Into this changed landscape stepped Desiderius Erasmus of Rotterdam. His 1499 visit, spent debating Greek with Thomas Lineker and William Grocyn, convinced him that a theologian must read sources in the original language. Within 3 years, Oxford had created a Regius Professorship of Greek. By 1517, arts candidates were examined in the language. Humanist pressure was tilting the curriculum ad fontes, back to the sources. humanism soon collided with the harsher currents of Henry VIII's Reformation. Royal commissioners dissolved monastic assets that had long funded colleges and ordered references to papal supremacy erased from statutes. The bloodiest episode followed under Mary I. In 1555, Bishops Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley were burned at the stake on Broad Street, and the former Archbishop Thomas Cranmer met the same fate a year later. The executions confirmed Oxford as a crucible where political power tested academic conscience. A more constructive legacy emerged in 1602, when Sir Thomas Bodley reopened the university's decayed library. He repaired Duke Humphrey's reading room, installed oak shelves fitted with iron chains, and in 1610, negotiated an agreement with the Stationers' Company that obliged every English publisher to deposit a copy of each new book. Scholarship now enjoyed a legal guarantee of intellectual supply. Within a decade, Bodley's shelves held Kepler's Astronomy, Sarpi's History of the Council of Trent, and the first quarto of Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, evidence that theological, scientific, and literary currents could meet under one roof. For the next two centuries, Oxford's colleges weathered civil war, restoration, and enlightenment, but the next major jolt came with the din of industry. By the 1840s, railway whistles echoed along the Isis, and Parliament asked whether a medieval university could serve an industrial nation. The Royal Commission of 1850 applied statistical scrutiny and found Oxford an ecclesiastical seminary for a narrow social section. The Universities of Oxford Act 1854 rewired governance, abolished most religious tests, and authorized new professorships in science and modern history. Intellectual renewal followed. The University Museum, completed in 1860, provided a dramatic stage for the celebrated exchange between Bishop Samuel Wilberforce and Thomas Huxley over Darwin's theory of evolution. On quieter northern lanes, Lady Margaret Hall and Somerville Hall opened in 1879, proving that women could match male standards in classics and mathematics even before they were granted degrees. By Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897, microscopes filled new laboratories behind the museum, and open scholarships had tripled since the commission first tallied them. The 20th century widened Oxford's horizon. Cecil Rhodes's will founded an annual cohort of international scholars in 1903, infusing tutorial rooms with prairie populism and New England pragmatism. During the Second World War, Howard Florey's team at the Dunn School transformed Alexander Fleming's chance observation into mass-produced penicillin, an achievement that earned a Nobel Prize in 1945 and reaffirmed Oxford's capacity for life-saving research. Post-war expansion produced graduate colleges such as Nuffield and St. Catharines, while Dorothy Crowfoot Hodgkin's crystallographic work on vitamin B12 secured Britain's first female Nobel Prize in science. Global ties deepened with organized research units. The Oxford Center for Islamic Studies, 1985, the Environmental Change Institute, 1991, and the Oxford Internet Institute, 2001, all drew international consortia. Student numbers rose from 12,000 in 1990 to more than 24,000 in 2022, 45% of them from outside the UK. The COVID-19 pandemic offered the sternest recent test. Within 10 days of obtaining the SARS-CoV-2 genome, the Jenner Institute had designed a vaccine candidate. By July 2021, more than a billion doses of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine had shipped worldwide, most at cost to low- and middle-income countries. Such capacity rests on governance willing to integrate philanthropy, public funding, and private enterprise. Nowhere is that synthesis clearer than in the story of the Said Business School. In 1996, Syrian-Saudi philanthropist Wafik Said pledged £20 million, since risen above £70 million, to endow a permanent business school. The disused Rowley Road Railway Yard became its site. Architects Edward Jones and Jeremy Dixon opened the glass-walled complex in 2001. A broad limestone forecourt echoes traditional quads while opening outward toward Frideswide Square. Inside, a 300-seat horseshoe-shaped lecture theater draws on amphitheater geometry to foster dialogue, and photovoltaic panels help the building meet BREEAM excellent standards. Programs multiplied quickly. The one-year MBA grew from 64 students in 1996 to 355 in 2023, representing 63 nationalities. Electives in social finance, healthcare innovation, and climate entrepreneurship leverage expertise across the wider university. Research outputs influence corporate governance codes, fintech regulation, and climate policy. The Skoll Center for Social Entrepreneurship, founded in 2003, hosts an annual forum that has helped ventures serving an estimated 120 million beneficiaries. Meanwhile, the Oxford Foundry and the student-run Seed Fund provide laboratories, capital, and mentoring for startups ranging from biomimetic drones to quantum computing. In less than three decades, the Said Business School has become a globally ranked institution that attracts 13,000 executive education participants annually. Its atrium still opens directly onto towpaths and Georgian terraces, reminding students that they build on nine centuries of dialogue. That invitation, fusing entrepreneurial energy with critical, ethical, and historical lenses, now shapes both the ventures launched in co-working labs and the debates held under medieval hammer beam roofs. Arriving in Oxford is simplest by rail. Most trains from London Paddington cover the 63-mile route in just under an hour and deposit passengers at the 19th-century station on the city's west flank. Stepping onto the platform, you already stand within the perimeter of academic modernity. The glass and limestone volumes of the Said Business School rise directly opposite. From here, the historic center lies a 10-minute walk east, a distance that traces the line by which steam-age Oxford merged into its medieval core. Follow Park End Street until it bends into New Road, keeping the Norman mound of Oxford Castle on your right. A spiral path leads to the summit, and on clear mornings, the viewpoint previews your itinerary. The tapering spire of St. Mary the Virgin, the octagonal dome of the Radcliffe Camera, and farther north, the serrated skyline of St. John's. At New Road's eastern end stands Carfax Tower, generally accepted as Oxford's geographic center. Municipal bylaws prohibit new construction that would rise higher than its 23 meters, so the brief climb up its internal stairway provides a reliable orientation. Your route heads east along High Street, which Matthew Arnold called the city's noblest thoroughfare. Begin at the corner where the gilded clock of the former University Press strikes the quarter hours. On the left, the Queen's Lane Coffee House claims provenance from 1654, one of the establishments that introduced Levantine stimulants to Restoration England. A morning cappuccino here bridges commerce and scholarship. On quiet weekdays, you may overhear dons debating exam timetables. A few paces farther, the long, pale facade of University College announces the earliest of Oxford's collegiate foundations. Inside, the Shelley Memorial shelters a marble effigy of the poet, sculpted in 1893. Detour through Logic Lane, named for the scholastic disputations once held in adjoining cloisters, and re-emerge beside Queen's College, whose symmetrical courtyard reflects Palladian principles. From here, the High Street curves toward Magdalen College, founded in 1458. Its bell tower leads May morning celebrations each 1st of May, when choristers sing Te Deum at 6 o'clock. Arrive by 5:30, or the police cordon will close the approaches. For lunch, the Vaults and Garden Cafe beneath St. Mary's North Porch sources vegetables from the university's Witham Fields, and its vaulted 13th-century cellar offers shelter if rain strikes. In fair weather, the terrace supplies direct sight lines to Radcliffe Square. The circular Radcliffe Camera, completed in 1749, serves as a reading room for history and theology. 30-minute guided tours include the medieval Duke Humphrey's Library and the 17th-century Convocation House. Walk north along Cat Street to the Sheldonian Theatre, Christopher Wren's first major commission, whose cupola offers a panorama stretching to Blenheim's distant parkland. Turn west into Broad Street. Blackwell's bookshop at number 50 hides the Norrington Room, more than 3 miles of shelving, beneath the pavement. Across the street, a granite cross marks the execution site of the Marian martyrs, its coordinates matching diocesan court rolls preserved at Lambeth Palace. If weather permits, continue to University Parks and hire a punt at the Parson's Pleasure Station. Local custom dictates that the punter stands on the rear deck, not the bow, favored by Cambridge. Summer congestion is heavy after 2:30. A morning circuit affords quieter stretches where kingfishers have been sighted during recent ornithological censuses. Museum-minded visitors should instead allocate at least an hour to the Pitt Rivers Museum, whose dense typological displays reflect General Augustus Pitt Rivers' obsession with systematic classification. By late afternoon, a restorative pint at the Turf Tavern, approached through St. Helen's Passage beneath the Bridge of Sighs, offers both refreshment and anecdote. A boundary stone in the rear courtyard marks the medieval limits of St. John's Parish, and wartime intelligence files list the pub as a favored off-duty haunt of codebreakers attending accelerated language courses. Non-drinkers can sample masala chai and vegetarian dosas along Cowley Road, whose cafes reflect post-war immigration patterns recorded in county census data. Dinner options range accordingly. For classical ambience, choose Quad, housed in a former banking hall on High Street. For contemporary British menus, emphasizing sustainable sourcing, the Cherwell Boathouse publishes catch receipts from Cornish dayboats in compliance with Marine Stewardship Council guidelines. Evening light is best captured in the cloister garth of New College, whose walls retain arrow slits from 15th century town defenses. Choir practice often fills the air with Byrd's four-part mass, the chapel's stone vault sustaining a two-second reverberation ideal for polyphony. Oxford operates largely as a pedestrian city between 10 in the morning and 6 in the evening. 5 park-and-ride lots encircle the ring road, and cyclists should note that High Street bus lanes are camera-monitored. Seasonal considerations matter. July brings daylight past 9:30, but also tour group congestion and average highs of 23 degrees Celsius. October's first fortnight coincides with the university's Michaelmas start, when streets buzz with new undergraduates, yet hotel rates dip after summer crowds depart. January sees mean temperatures around 2 degrees, though dawn mist over Christchurch Meadow eerily recalls the watery conditions in which 12th century scholars first gathered. Half-hourly buses reach the Cotswold village of Burford, where 15th century wool merchant houses illustrate the rural wealth that once underwrote college endowments. A short train ride north reaches Woodstock and Blenheim Palace, birthplace of Winston Churchill. Yet even a single well-planned day within the Ring Road can embed the spectrum of Oxford's story. You start amid global business students and end beneath medieval vaulting. You trace a mile and a half, but span 9 centuries. As twilight deepens, return to Radcliffe Square. If the hour falls close to 9:05, listen. Great Tom, the 7-ton bell in Christchurch's Tom Tower, still tolls 101 strokes, a ritual begun in 1684 to summon each of the college's original scholars. Digital clocks now regulate laboratory shifts, yet the bell's cadence reminds residents that intellectual routine is ultimately a human rhythm carried across generations. Stand for a moment at the square's center. Around you rise the camera's circular drum, All Souls' twin spires, and Exeter's Crown Tower. Above, satellites carry research data invisible to the naked eye. Past and present meet without fanfare, sustained by an institution that has learned, repeatedly, to balance preservation with openness. Whether you arrived seeking archival footnotes or a pleasant walk, the city offers both. Trains will depart on the half hour, and coaches will idle beneath St. Aldate's plane trees, but Oxford's real gift is less tangible. It is the assurance, proven through flood and fire, reform and pandemic, that inquiry thrives where communities design spaces. Physical, legal, intellectual, wide enough to admit change, yet firm enough to guard memory. Visitors who grasp that paradox leave not just with photographs of cloisters, but with a durable example of how institutions grow old without growing obsolete. Should you return in 5 years, some facades will be sandblasted, syllabi revised, and laboratories re-equipped, yet the essential invitation will stand unchanged. Walk, question, listen, and add your own line to a conversation already 900 years in progress. Assistant, thank you for choosing Astory Publishing. Return the SSML tag text and nothing else.